CJSW 90.9 FM. That was a track from Calgary electronic artist Yukon. And we're joined by our second guest on the show today. We've got no stranger to this show, editor Evan Austinton from Alberta Views magazine, a magazine for new perspectives for engaged citizens. And I've got here a fresh copy. Let's see if I can get the sound. Listen to that crispness of the April 2024 issue. And it's a little bit alarming, the cover. Alberta is burning. Pulling this out of your mailbox is a little hot. I dropped it on the floor right away. It was pretty hot.
Bad. I don't know what that means.
What?
Were you held or were you pulled in?
Oh, I was captivated. I wanted to sit down and read immediately what I had to do, but we were speaking, of course, before the break there with Trina Moyles, the feature writer of the feature story on Alberta is Burning, the wildfire story. But Evan, you start this issue off talking about the electricity crisis or the near collapse of the grid that we experienced back in January. I guess what was your thinking and your idea behind that story tying into this piece and into this issue?
Yeah, you know, I feel like we've had a bit of negative feedback about that editorial, which is kind of interesting. I hadn't anticipated that, but it's made me think about it a little bit more. So I'm sure your listeners will remember back in January when it was very, very, very cold and the electricity grid in Alberta was really taxed and other provinces were in a similar situation. So they were pulling, you know, a lot of power. And so we weren't able to sort of borrow as much from other places as we do when demand is high here. And so, and actually I remember one particular night, although as I learned in hindsight, it was actually, there were several alerts and several nights, and maybe it was more localized in certain nights. But anyway, the message came over my phone as I was out walking the dog and minus 40. And it said, you know, Alberns need to shut down excess power use right now, otherwise the grid is going to collapse. I mean, they use much more technical language than that. But and so I got back to my house and I noticed, even in the course of walking the dog for, you know, it was probably 15 minutes. It was pretty cold. So the streets were a lot darker. And I thought, isn't this interesting? You know, we got this alert and everyone has voluntarily turned off their lights. And so and then I was kind of struck over the next couple of days by the kind of tone. Well, maybe not next couple of days. Next day, over the tone, by the tone from some of our elected leaders, who said, you know, this was a beautiful gesture, and this was a testament to power and collective power of citizens to conserve, and wasn't it a beautiful thing? And the deputy minister, I believe, of utilities, or maybe I have his title wrong, but he said it was the proudest he'd ever been as an Albertan, the proudest he'd ever been as a Canadian when he looked out in his neighborhood and saw people turn their lights off. And I thought, you know, there's a couple of ways to look at that. And you know, the thing that really struck me is how we could, in theory, you know, just, we could disagree about a lot of things, but in Alberta, but we can all agree on conservation and the value of conservation and the usefulness of that. And the problem was that people later, you know, got in touch with me and said, you're missing the point. The point is not, you know, whether conservation is good or not, or whether people, that was a good thing or a bad thing, or, you know, the point is that who is using the most electricity? It's not the residential user. It's not you and I at home who need to turn off our space heaters necessarily and our lights. It's who's using the most power in this province. It's in the industrial scale consumer. And how many of them were moved to reduce their power use during this crisis in January? How many of them, you know, voluntarily or otherwise reduced their power use? And so that's maybe the larger issue. Like, you know, conservation on the residential scale is not going to make much of a difference, but conservation at a commercial or industrial scale might make all the difference. So, but that wasn't, my point was not to say, you know, this is as important as industrial scale conservation. It was to say that this is something we can do. It's something that we can maybe even agree on, you know, conservatives and moderates and progressives or whatever can all agree on the value of this. And that's something our government can do and has done in the past, has taken a role in promoting conservation. And it's also, there's an irony. I'll stop going on my rant here, but there is an irony to this too, which is, of course, this is a government that says, we're trying to make your life more affordable. We're trying to reduce cost of living for everyone, and it's such a crisis. And here's an opportunity for, and electricity is a is not cheap now. So here's, an, I mean, I know it's not just the cost for your actual usage, but the delivery charges and the rest. But still, that's a pretty easy way. Turn off the lights you're not using. That's a pretty easy way to save some money. It's good for the environment, builds community resilience, all the rest of it. And it just seemed like that's something we can all agree on. Something little, maybe. Maybe we can all agree on. So that's where I started. Mm-hmm.
Interesting also that since probably you sent this, this went to press, the Alberta government came out with their renewables energy, I guess, regulations, maybe air quotes, or restrictions imposed strictly, specifically on that one industry, with rules applying to solar and wind, but not coal mining or oil and gas on the exact same land in the exact same locations. Protecting the viewscape of a mountaintop while mining, like open pit mountaintop removal, mining said mountaintop, I guess, smacks of a little bit of hypocrisy, maybe, or double standard.
Yeah, I'm sort of in a wait and see mode on this whole renewables moratorium or the new regulations, because, you know, the first maps I saw basically excluded 90% of the province from any kind of renewable electricity development. And then subsequently, you know, up to date or more up to date maps, I saw, okay, it's not quite as dire. It's still going to really have an impact on the industry. And I don't really understand what it's going to do for existing renewables. So I'm not anything like an expert on this. I'm just kind of following along like a lot of people, but it is a little bit alarming that we had, you know, a booming renewables industry, and we could have probably resolved some of the issues that people were having in terms of where these places were being located. I mean, they don't certainly don't need to be in the middle of farmland. There's plenty of other land that could be used for this, as we wrote about last fall. I think you had Ian Urquhart on to talk about that. So, yeah, it's a little little confusing. And
I'm holding off for the first person who's going to put a wind turbine on a decommissioned pump jack.
I mean, that's been it's been happening. You know, these sites are being repurposed because the land's already cleared. There's already access roads. So if the wells are reclaimed or as part of the reclamation process, you can put in solar. That was part of Ian Urquhart's story last fall.
Might be a loophole there. I guess maybe along those same lines, we've got in this issue a feature on Rebecca Schultz, Minister of Environment and Protected Areas, I guess in title, but in practice.
In title, yeah.
Maybe something else?
Yeah. How you need to put in your scare quotes for Minister of Environment. It is really quite striking that, yeah, she really is the energy minister, but she gets this title of Environment and Protected Areas and really is out there just championing oil and gas industry, which is, you know, fine. Maybe the energy minister can do that, but I don't know why we need two ministers, one of whom is called Minister of Environment, also to do that. It's a little odd.
Yeah, very very interesting with that one. And then, of course, that maybe takes us to the battle of the optimists versus the pessimists in this month's dialogue feature. You've got Chris Turner and Andrew Nikiforuk. Tell us a little bit about the ultimate duo that's that makes this piece.
Yeah, so the question we asked this month was, should we be optimistic about our climate future? And arguing yes for optimism is Chris Turner, and arguing no, I guess, for pessimism would be Andrew Nikiforuk, both authors that we think many of your listeners would be familiar with for their books and for their nonfiction writing. So, they make their best cases. And should I put you on the spot and say which way you're leaning? Are you with the...
You know, I don't mind you putting me on the spot. I find it's possible to experience both at the same time, to feel optimistic about, I mean, Chris Turner brings in much needed perspective, looking back at 20 years of sort of how far we came, where it was like, you know, 20, 30 years ago, it was like Bob's solar powered calculator. And today we have, or last year alone, I think the stat he uses here was that there was more new solar power brought on the grid than all the nuclear generation on the globe in existence. And just to sort of give that perspective of how far we come, still obviously a long way to go. But then on the flip side, I mean, it's hard to imagine how just flipping all the cars on the road to electric vehicles is the be all and end all, is the solution to the crisis we're in, and that, you know, mining energy to mining minerals is simply the fix. And so maybe it's possible to believe it's a bit of both. It's that we do need to make changes to the way we organize cities, and to expectations that maybe you don't need to drive everywhere, or not everyone needs to own a car, and that we can make cities much more sustainable in that sense. What was your impression after reading these two pieces?
You know, I'm probably with you. I mean, I don't feel pessimistic all the time, although I can certainly get kind of stuck there. And I definitely don't would not say that I get stuck in optimism. I sort of yo-yo between them depending on the day and depending on the context. But I will say, you know, not too long, I guess it was a few decades ago, I was at that campus, you know, and I was it was the year 2000, and I ran for the Green Party of Canada as a federal candidate in the year 2000. And I remember thinking at the time, you know, climate change is coming. Nobody knows. Nobody's heard of this. This is like an existential, world-ending, apocalyptic problem. And I would go to someone's door, and I would knock on the door, and they'd say, you know, what are you doing here? I'm campaigning for the Green Party in Calgary West. And they would sort of metaphorically pat me on the head. That's adorable. Good for you. You know, pat, here's a dollar. You know, good luck to you, son. You're doing the right thing.
Yeah, like your green socks.
Yeah, and nobody was threatened. Nobody, you know, argued with me. Nobody took issue with what I was standing for. Nobody said, you know, this is all a lie. Everyone just, it was accepted, but also completely dismissed. And I just remember thinking, I am of no threat to anyone here, and no one. And anyway, so here we are. It's 23 years later, 24 years later, and yeah, there are people who are, this entire industry set up to deny the existence of climate change, or to downplay it, or to, you know, postpone the solutions as long as possible. Like it's perceived as a major, it is perceived as what it is now, an existential threat to all of, you know, humanity and all of wildlife. And so from that standpoint, it does feel like we've come a long way as a society. We've gone from not being aware and dismissing the problem to being very aware of it, embracing it in some ways, denying it in other ways, but at least it's absolutely top of mind. I mean, there's no way you'd have, the environment is not a fringe issue now. Now, as you say, it's not enough to just, even if we were able to electrify all cars, you know, instantly or almost instantly, is that anywhere near enough? No, of course not. I mean, what are batteries made out of? Electric cars are heavier, you know, what are roads made out of? So there's a lot more to it than just changing the fuel source. But if we can, in just over two decades, go from this issue is not on anyone's radar, and I'm anyone who stands for the environment is kind of a kook or a harmless kook, to this is the issue of our times. And if we can go from nobody was thinking about electric cars really 20 odd years ago, and now they're mainstream and getting more so, I don't know, we're going to have to do the same kind of turnaround that perhaps is happening with electric cars and with electricity sources. We're going to have to do the same thing with mining and with our food sources and with our transportation sector and everything else. And I don't know. I mean, there's a part of me that thinks we're not up for it. And there's a part of me that thinks, well, what choice do we have? But, you know, just to keep plugging away on this and fixing what we can and trying to not create more problems at the same time. And we'll see what happens. And something like what we have will push through, and it won't be what we have now. And there'll be a lot of transition and suffering along the way, but some semblance of what of civilization will continue is my kind of final thought, I guess.
To me, it's a, it's a, it's amazing the number of parallels with the tobacco industry, and it's that I think is one of the reasons why I really did think that federal NDP motion to or a private member's bill, I think it was, to ban fossil fuel advertising, essentially the greenwashing we're seeing right now, because what we're getting through their various alliances and things is advertising that that counters the urgency of the crisis and counters the urgency of energy transition. And if we were to have, allowed tobacco companies to continue advertising to counter the threat to human health that cigarette smoking and secondhand smoke pose, we probably wouldn't be where we are today with smoking rates going down. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's a matter of time before that another bill like that or something similar starts to see the light mm-hmm. of day again, because really we're just going to see more resistance. And as we've seen with Suncor, the new CEO, the ex-CEO of Imperial Oil coming on board and basically reversing that company's efforts to energy transition. The industry isn't kind of do this out of their own goodwill. Their primary, job is to make money, and as long as we incentivize that and give them free rein, we're not going to see the action that we need. My little rant.
Yeah, well, just about the the oil sands emissions cap. It's kind of interesting that in 2015 you had industry on board for this whatever it was 100 megaton cap, and of course it's a totally different government now 8 years later, 9 years later. But now that's completely impossible and unrealistic. And so, but yeah, back to your point about advertising. I think it's possible that there was a time when if you could have banned certain types of advertising, you would have had a large impact on social behavior. And now I'm not sure if it's the case. I mean, I don't even know where I see, ads anymore. I'm not someone who watches channels 4 and 5. I'm dating myself here. I see ads on the internet, but I mean, even if you banned all fossil fuel advertising today, there's still social media, there's still Twitter, there's still whatever the other networks are that all the kind of crazy hate mongering conspiracy theories are going around on. You don't need to advertise on there. People are plenty capable of.
There's lots of ways around it for sure. But
I worry a little bit about what social media has done now. Maybe advertising is no longer as influential as it used to be.
As health influencers, my friend, taking on your own personal responsibility for solving the climate crisis.
Did we come down on the side of pessimism?
I think we landed on pessimism.
Andrew Nikiforuk might have won. Sorry, Chris Turner, if you're listening.
You know what, though? I love heat pumps.
This audience of two.
I love how, as much as I don't want to shift I don't think we should be shifting the responsibility of, solving the climate crisis on individuals. It's very much a larger industrial problem to solve through governments. And we'll hear more about how the world is burning in just a moment on the BBC News. I do love the idea how people can just switch away from gas and install a heat pump or throw some solar panels up on the roof. So, or make that trip by bicycle or by foot. So
maybe that could be the outcome of the funding drive next year, is the station can get a geothermal pump or a heat pump. Sorry, heat pump.
We could get a heat pump tower. We'll see if we can do that, and we can put it on top of a decommissioned pump jack. How about that?
I was thinking you put it up on campus, but okay.
I'm sure that would also be doable. Evan, always a pleasure having you on. Thanks for the little chat on the April issue here this month.
Thanks, Peter.
Once again, Evan Austinton, editor of Alberta Views magazine. You can pick up the April issue on newsstands. And we'll flip over to the BBC News here and be back with more of the Calgary Almanac after this.
This is the BBC News. every weekday morning on CJSW 90.9 FM in Calgary.
BBC News with...